Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Praise of Folly. Now, Praise of Folly is a YouTuber. I've been aware of him for years. I think I can remember him back in 2014, or definitely 2015. And he describes himself as a paleo-conservative, low-church Protestant. And he does philosophical videos, debates. He does used to do a lot of hangouts. I remember the good old days of Google Hangouts. That platform, that's now gone, of course. It was axed by Google, I think, in 2019. That was a shame because that was a key part of our kind of thing back then. So welcome, Praise of Folly.
Yeah, well, thank you, Millennial Woes. I don't know if you remember, but you had me on once as a random guest on an episode you did called The Nature of Equality.
Oh.
That led to a very interesting, long conversation.
Yes, I do remember that. That was a Google Hangout, and it had quite a lot of people on it. I seem to recall. I seem to remember it being a busy and a bit of a haphazard hangout.
I think even the Franklin was on it under a different name.
Oh yes, he would be a reactionary expat in those days.
Right. Yes. Well, thank you for having me on.
No, you're welcome. So. And I should say that the Franklin is going to appear on Millennial twice this year. He's going to have his own episode, and then he'll be appearing with Pale Hominid, I think, the night after that. So, okay. And, of course, Pale Hominid was another character in those days who some people will remember. Now, Praise of Folly, I asked you on to get your perspective on the current global situation, because we do seem to be living through a pivotal moment in history. Certain things have emerged that we were perhaps tangentially aware of, but we've realized how well. What would you say? I don't want to put words in your mouth. What would you say about the last 2 years?
I think they're extremely important. What I would say is there's a lot of normies that think and hope that we can just get back to 2019. You know, just we put up with this long enough and we'll go back to the normal that was 2019. For a variety of reasons, I don't think we'll ever be going back to 2019, and that what COVID represents is more of a flashpoint for deeper structural civilizational weaknesses in an analogous way to the powder keg of Europe in 1914. The Archduke was the fuse that his assassination by the Black Hand terrorists was the fuse that lit the whole thing up. I feel like we're in a similar place where there's a lot of global structural weaknesses, of which COVID-19 is the sort of assassin's bullet, so to speak.
So in that sense, I mean, hold on a sec, I'll mute. In that, obviously, the assassin's bullet killing Franz Ferdinand, that was the catalyst, that was the thing that enabled lots of tensions to erupt and into world war, full-blown war involving, I don't know how many nations now, I can't remember now, but I think the difference with COVID is that this seems to be, it's not so much that the COVID has been a catalyst, or it's more like it's been an excuse for not for tensions to erupt, but for systems to manifest that wanted to manifest for some time.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but what I'm saying is, if we look at, say, the global shipping distribution system of just-in-time delivery, for a very long time people have predicted the possible danger of disruption to that system that a pandemic might cause. I even remember, like, what, 10 or so years ago, the History Channel actually did a what-if scenario coming out of China, no less, a super disease was spread all over the world. Now, in that sense, I think it's showing deeper structural issues. Now, in the sense that you're talking about, which I also agree is true, there is a kind of authoritarian, totalitarian control grid that they were waiting for an excuse to implement.
Yeah, I think we're in agreement. So that is the excuse. And this control grid has emerged. Now, how would you describe that control grid?
I think that what we can see here is that the first element of this control grid being rolled out is the technocratic plan for global government, going back to British authors like H.G. Wells in his The Open Conspiracy and New World Order, or Bertrand Russell's The Impact of Science on Society, and also Huxley's Brave New World. There was this idea of elite, progressive, scientific-minded Englishmen who were thinking that we should roll out this technocratic society that would be utopian and would make the world perfect. And that same ideology that undergirds all of this is manifested in the United States as well. In a more narrow sense, we see the rise of a sort of a tyranny of medicine, where the idea that, in a way analogous to the medieval era, the new priesthood, the new caste are, instead of, you know, Catholic clerics, are doctors in white lab coats, and the greatest evil to fight is not heresy, but illness.
Which, of course, is a great pretext, because it enables all sorts of diktats, because everyone has their health to worry about. Everyone, that's something that touches everyone. And so you can get many, many people on board with quite heavy-handed measures. It's a great pretext for technocracy.
Oh yes, exactly. And one of the things we also see with this kind of like a 1-2 punch is, under the more, you know, lax neoliberal 80s and 90s, you know, junk food and junk bonds, they sort of got people addicted to living in a very unhealthy way, in a way that without modern medicine, modern structures, they wouldn't be able to live. So, and to put it in a more abstract sense, the French critic of technology, Jacques Ellul, in his On Technique, points out that the system, the technical system that is being rolled out, demands a couple of things. And one, I think, is very relevant to the alt-right and its concern for white preservation. The idea is social plasticity, the idea that any rapidly changing technological society, we can't have any identities that get in the way of the dissemination of knowledge. So you, back in the medieval and early Renaissance periods, you had trade secrets. You had ideas that, you know, you can't sell this information to somebody else because that would violate this guild norm or this religious norm or this ethnic norm. But if that happens all over the place, it limits the spread of ideas and limits the growth of technology. So in a sort of spontaneous matter, there's this drive to efface all of these presences, which would allow for the swifter dissemination of knowledge, but has all sorts of catastrophic consequences, of which the alt-right is pinpointing one of them.
Well, I mean, obviously, yeah, a swifter dissemination of knowledge, and yet what we see in the last 2 years is also the swift censoring of knowledge, so that because it's not really about knowledge, is it? I mean, ostensibly, technocracy is, we are driven by the data, and we arrive at the best prognosis and the best the best plan based on the data, and we do it objectively and all this. But really, it's not like that, is it? Because they've clearly censored awareness of alternative treatments that for COVID that would have been, it looks like they would have been very effective. And I mean, literally, you can get banned from YouTube, or you can get, I don't know, you can get strikes. I imagine that you, again, this is another example of how the rules aren't really the rules. They'll say that you'd get a strike, but really, if they want to, they'll just ban you for saying that ivermectin or hydrochloroquine, or there's a third one now, that they would be effective treatments, even though there's very good reason to believe that those would be effective treatments. So, and then other stuff to do with the vaccine, its effectiveness, its side effects. If it were all about the acquisition of knowledge and being objective and all that, they wouldn't be doing this censorship. They would actually want these ideas out there so that they could be judged objectively. But that's not what's happening, is it?
What I would say is the ideas that they want to disseminate are merely operational knowledge, knowledge of how machines work or systems work, which is self-contained to their, because they need that to impose their grid on society. Actual truth about other things that has nothing to do with the process of efficiency doesn't, they don't care about that. I think what you're getting at was something that was mentioned by Bill Joy in Wired magazine in 2000, why the future doesn't need us. And he's describing his own class of technical elites, that they have this essentially a God complex of either wanting to massively reduce the human population for the good of the planet or have a bunch of pliable serfs to mold in their own image. And that really, I think, is this idea where we see the technocratic elite trying to build the world in their image. They think that technology has allowed them to sort of transgress the sort of laws of society and nature that we might broadly call perennial truths. Well, it's different now. We have science. And because it's different and because we have science, we can do everything differently the way we want.
So in fact, then we're heading towards that cliche of power corrupting and people overreaching, rulers. Actually, I'm just reminded of your own nom de plume, Praise of Folly. It's a situation where rulers are going to do things thinking that they are infallible. They're going to do things that are actually disastrous. What would you say about that?
Exactly. What I would say is that what leads, well, there's a couple things that lead leaders to this position. One is the shooting the messenger syndrome, where once you get powerful enough and ensconced enough, you only want to hear things that agree with what you're thinking, and you have this tendency, both figuratively and literally, to shoot the messenger. So we saw this in World War II with Joseph Stalin, right? Nobody wanted to report defeats on the fronts at the hands of the Nazi panzer divisions because they were afraid of getting shot. So they just told Stalin what he wanted to hear. We also see that, for example, Hayek in his knowledge theory problem talks about how if you have a hierarchical structure and you have events happening all at once, if it's too sclerotic, it takes too much time for the facts on the ground to pass up to the top for a decision to be made, for it to be passed down to the ground. That's just the time lag problem. And then lastly, technology itself is a moral hazard, which shelters people from the consequences of the decisions. And so I think these elites being the recipients of all three of these are really disconnected from any sort of real experience.
Well, indeed, they seem to occupy a rather hallowed realm where reality doesn't intervene very often. They're able to tell themselves and believe and tell each other things that are crazy, like things like that race isn't a real thing, that men and women are interchangeable, that different cultures can coexist. Now, they've been doing that for a long time. I guess what's different about COVID is that they're just inventing scientific truth as fits their purposes. I think that's the really unique thing, because I, and a lot of other people, I think, had an idea that science was kind of sacrosanct, even though I didn't. I always was skeptical of these people who say I fucking love science. I always thought that was dorky and stupid, and the new atheist crowd. But nonetheless, I assumed that science itself was fairly fairly free of corruption. That's another thing that has been another truth that has emerged in the last 2 years, that actually the scientific that sector is very corruptible. Would you have anything to say about that?
Exactly. In fact, the late Stephen Jay Gould once wrote that the myth that the scientist is a self-immolating seeker of the truth is a convenient myth. Even
well, that's good coming from him, I have to say.
Didn't he
fake the data so as to claim that race was about the skull sizes or something?
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. Now, what's interesting with how COVID has been done, it's so transparently fraudulent, right? So we're all told to, you know, wait in lockdown in, you know, March of 2021. Or 2020, and then we have all of these riots all over the country. No social distancing, no masks. And I said, but that's okay, because I guess, you know, fighting racism prevents you from getting COVID, I guess, right?
Well, I think for me, and I think for other people, this was a moment where you realize that this has to be a load of rubbish, because how can they say that it's okay for BLM to riot and that somehow won't spread the virus, or even that it had a positive effect on building up people's immunity or something like that? Whereas an anti-COVID, an anti-lockdown protest is a super spreader event. This reinventing of reality on the hoof as well, you know, just from one day to the next, is absolutely astounding.
Exactly. Now, what's also really interesting here, too, about this use of COVID to sort of redefine science, there it's a kind of idea of chutzpah. It's almost like you get to the point where you have so much power and so much untouchability that you sort of want to tip your hand and just sort of rub it in people's faces that it's so obvious that we can do this. And then there's nothing you can do, right? So there's this occult principle of where you have to show somebody what you're doing, and why you're doing it. It's a part of the law of equivalent exchange, where you have to show them what you're doing while you're doing it, and in so doing, you then show your power over them and insult them. And it's the peak of the power pyramid. Once you get to the top, then you can do it. Because nobody can stop you. And I also find it very interesting that leading up to the lockdowns, you know, they've been pushing rampant individualism for decades, making people less and less connected, burning, you know, all the social organizations that tied us together, family, churches, etc. And when we were at peak levels of isolation, they then force us to lock down to then emphasize that even more strongly. And when they did this rabbit out of the hat trick, nobody could really do anything about it. Because, I mean, who are you going to organize with to protest this? You know, we're all rootless cosmopolitans now.
But and they also replaced the old social bonds with a new system of collectivism. Now, I don't want to sully that word collectivism, because I still do believe in collectives and groups. But what we have now is a sickly collectivism where it's based on, well, it's just nothing. It's just global collectivism, where suddenly you've gone from 90s and 2000s individualism to this hyper awareness of your duty to look after other people by not threatening them with your, you know, biological dirtiness.
Exactly. It's a new morality, a new ethic. There was this idea in the 90s, you know, by amongst the new atheists that, well, you know, we had transcended Christianity, but not just Christianity, any sort of universal normative morality. And they thought that, well, you know, we won, right? Well, and then it turns out that once the religious right faded into distant memory, then their erstwhile allies on the left, beginning with Elevatorgate, I think it was like 2011, 2012, we started to see the division between the old school new atheists and atheism plus, the first wave of this progressivism. And this progressive totalitarianism, or what Bill Lynn called, the universities were ivy-covered North Koreas, this sort of like cultural Marxism that people like Bill Lynn started telling us about. And it came true. Those people, you know, that were the tail end of the religious right that lost, were warning us what was going to happen. And Bill Lind has lots of good material on cultural Marxism. And everybody was like, no, that's not going to happen. And then it happens.
Yeah, it was definitely a huge, again, an eye-opener for me that they can switch people, a public that has been shaped to be individualistic and selfish and disconnected from community and to not care about community. They can switch them almost overnight, really, to people who think that, well, my liberty doesn't really matter. It's more important, and even on a selfish level, how it makes them feel. It makes me feel better to know that I'm doing the right thing for everyone else. That makes me feel better than going out and being a free individual. I find this one of the most astonishing changes.
Yeah, it is. I think one thing that you could sort of begin to analyze this from is, well, some people, when they would object to Randian objectivism, saying that, well, you know, you do things that are quote unquote altruistic, and they're like, well, no, we believe that the things that you're calling altruistic that we're doing are actually egoistic for our benefit. We're doing it for selfish reasons, even if from your perspective, like say raising my kid, we're actually doing it for selfish reasons, even though it may look altruistic. Now, I doubt most, you know, Tumblr lesbians are that self-aware, but I think it's that kind of, they're a train running on that kind of track. Well, from our perspective, it looks altruistic. They're doing it from a subjective sense of selfishness and personal gain. And the way they view that is by status. They believe that they can gain status by doing this.
Yeah, you might well be right, actually. It might be wholly self-serving in the way that virtue signaling always has been. In our era, we've always despised, you know, people in our circles have always looked down on virtue signaling as a transparent attempt at self-advertising. It might well be that. I think that people wear the mask, that there's clearly a lot of self-righteousness in that. But I also think that a lot of people, it really is. I mean, you can see they are worried. There are people who are genuinely scared of COVID and of other people, especially when they see someone who's not masked. I mean, there are multiple clips, thing, mobile phone footage of someone on the train or whatever, kicking up a fuss because someone else doesn't have the mask on. And I genuinely think that a lot of it is not sort of hollow virtue signaling. It's people, and again, maybe I'm being naive here, but I think it's people genuinely thinking that they're not just signaling virtue, they are being virtuous. I'm not sure if there's how much difference there is between those two things, really, but what would you say about that?
I think what you're getting at is something that Jean Baudrillard in Simulacra on Simulation helps us to understand. He has four levels of simulation, where simulation level one is a reasonable imitation of the real thing, culminating up to simulation level four, the simulacra, which is completely disconnected from anything real, and criticizing it for any sense of, you know, naive fidelity to the real is viewed as foolish and silly. And in fact, this simulacra, an identity completely distinct from anything real, which Baudrillard calls the hyperreal, is something that begins to resent reality itself, because in some sense it's competing for the same space in people's minds with reality. And what I would argue is that these people you're describing, that we're seeing all over the country and the world, are the first people that have finally transitioned all the way into hyper-reality, where they are completely disassociated from anything real to the point that it's now hyper-real and they think that that's the new real.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. And I think you might be right that at this point, people don't, to a lot of people, it does not matter that what they believe contradicts what they're seeing with their own eyes. Like the fact that they don't know anyone who's died from COVID, that they don't know of anyone who's died from COVID, but that doesn't matter to them. They now are in the world created for them by the media and by the powers that be.
Exactly. And there was a really good film about from the 60s, I think it was called 50s, called Kim, where there was a Indian boy trained by British special forces to sort of spy on the Russians, who they were afraid were going to invade Afghanistan. This is like during the Great Games, so like the 1880s. And in the film, while they're breaking down this Indian boy to condition him to then rebuild him in their own image, they drop a plate. And they tell him that we will tell you that this plate is not being broken, but reassembling. And through in repeated attempts at indoctrination, they get him, you know, to see the plate coming back together as they break it. Or what Bertrand Russell said, we're going to use psychological conditioning to tell you that black is white and white is black. And if we point to a black thing and call it white, you'll believe it. And it's this holistic level of psychological conditioning that has been going on for decades that is also at fault here, too.
So you end up with this situation where people who think of themselves as very rational are as irrational as any, you know, because you've got this whole thing where they love to pour scorn on the religious, you know, magic man in the sky, some ancient book, doctrine that doesn't make sense and that contradicts itself. But they are now as guilty of those things as anyone.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think also to sort of further explain this by a reference to Baudrillard again, he makes the distinction that in the age of the simulacra, the famous slogan, the medium is the message, creates what he calls a world of collapsed meaning. Because when the medium becomes the message, then the message disappears, and we move away from a world of language and meaning and text to one of a collapsed meaning of material symbols.
Well, that's something I don't know about, so I'm not sure if I can comment on that. Do you think that this is an age that we simply have to live through, or is there any way to reverse it? I mean, it seems to me that obviously leaving power aside, just leaving that question aside, would it be possible to talk people out, like the ordinary, the public, would it be possible to talk them out of this, or are they so deep into this way of thinking that it just has to run its course and many people might live and die under this way of thinking?
I think we're at the end of Brave New World, where Smith the Savage takes the box of Selma and says, this is enslaving you, and dashes it on the ground, and the people try to kill Smith. I feel like we're there, in which case we have to live through this. Or to put it another way, at the end of the Christmas Carol, when Scrooge sees the ghost of Christmas future, he's told that if you persist in a way of action long enough, then all the other variables are accounted for and your outcome is predetermined. And if by going through this trial, I think in some sense, well, it wasn't predetermined 100 years ago. I think it is now.
That's so interesting. I mean, at what point is an alternative history thing. At what point do you think it became that we were just destined for this?
That's a very interesting question. There's a lot of nuances, but I think for the United States and by extension the West, the decade 1910 to 1920 is really the event horizon of this. In 1913, we get the Federal Reserve Bank, which allows these technocrats to have essentially limitless funding. They start World War One, at least by hauling the United States into it for the express purpose of social reengineering. In the 1950s, there was a congressional investigation under the Dodd Committee, which exposes that. And then women got the vote in 1920. That decade placed all the pieces in place for the technocratic elite to have the unlimited upper hand, because they controlled the money supply. They could socially engineer Americans by getting us involved in war and then, you know, getting us to give up our freedoms and our common sense for the sake of, you know, defeating the Krauts, you know, and that gave them a winning hand.
Another thing that happened that in that decade was, well, obviously the sinking of the Titanic would be perhaps, I don't know, perhaps relevant, but certainly relevant is World War One, because that signaled the end of that entire epoch in Western history of dynasties, monarchy, aristocracy, and an inherited. But more fundamentally than that, I think that signals the end of a certain way of appreciating the world and reality, which you could characterize as a very masculine way of and hierarchical. It's explicitly hierarchical. I think you could legitimately say that we have since then entered a more feminine age, obviously culminating with this obsession with safety now, but also just relativism in general and a lack of objectivity. What would you say about that?
I agree. I think what broadly what you described up till 1914 was a world we might call spiritual or idealistic, you know, in the philosophical sense of appealing to immaterial ideals like Plato. And then it's been replaced by a world of materialism and machines. And we see sort of like what Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings is sort of like explaining that transition as something terrible, right? So he's defending the old way, this old spiritual aristocratic way. And, you know, that's represented by the free peoples of Middle Earth, and Sauron and Mordor represent this new material, mechanical, homogeneous world. And of course, for Tolkien, ground zero was the trenches. And so it's the birth of this new order in the trenches of machines. Because I don't remember exactly where I heard this, but there was an interview with Jack Donovan, I think it was by Richard Spencer, where he was talking about why corporations like women and lesbians and homosexuals and not straight heterosexual men. And it's because they're more dependent on the system. They're not as autonomous. They rely on these structures to exist. And so naturally enough, these structures are going to want to staff themselves with such people, because unlike cis white men who are going to dynamite factories in West Virginia, as they did in the 1920s, they're not going to do that. These new group of workers, quote unquote, aren't going to do this. And in the machine age, the sort of raw masculinity that we used to see in the past is seen as obsolete because it's seen as threatening to the efficient operating of the machine.
Absolutely. And then the show of force that you do see in this age, apart from the impersonal, almost mechanistic force of the state and equivalent bodies, the other show of force that you see is Antifa, which I think is, again, a very feminine force. I think one of the defining things about Antifa is that you've got all these young men who are completely disconnected from their masculinity. They're hysterical. They're literally hysterical. So they're very feminized. Now, again, I don't want this to be to be seen as a screed against women or even femininity. I just think that society should not be dominated by that. Society should be dominated by a masculine way of thing, because I think that's the only way that you can have stability and a drive towards truth, frankly.
Yeah, you see, I think what's interesting here, as we're sort of zeroing in on this point, is if we look at the sort of perennial realities of Europe over, you know, through the Homeric Bronze Age, the Classical Age, the Catholic Medieval Era, the Protestant Era. These perennial truths of, you know, hierarchy and clan and masculine rule were all more or less accepted. These other religions, these other systems had to accommodate themselves to that. What we see, though, with this radical reversal of roles is only made possible as a result of these technological forces. Like, for example, without feminine hygiene products, it's inconceivable that women could have taken the place they have in society today. Without antibiotics, it's difficult to see how all these sexual minorities could have taken the role they have in society today. So technology is the means by which this flipping of the script has occurred.
It's the means by which the weak are able to overpower the strong.
Exactly.
Let's leave it at that, because I know it's been short, but I think this has been absolutely fascinating. And I think that it's not just because I've got to get onto the next stream. I think that this has been a fantastic compression of different ideas. And I think that it's been a great starting point. So is there anything you'd like to say just to wrap up?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you very much, Millennial Woes, for having me on. This has been an absolute pleasure. I would say that I think a really interesting piece of analytical advice would be for the alt-right thinkers and these alt-right listeners to look at the sort of what I broadly call the tech skeptic position and how the world of myth and aristocracy and honor was removed and destroyed by technology and commented on by these various authors I mentioned, people like C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, people like Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells, people like Ivan Illich and Jacques Ellul. And that, I think, will add a very helpful lens to explain a lot of the madness that we see in the world today.
Okay. Thank you. I think this has been a really good stream. So, all right, Praise of Folly, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
Thank you, Millennial.
All right. Excellent. I'll be back soon with the next stream. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.